I take an interview with the Weathermakers, an extremely ambitious project focusing on restoring the water cycles in the Mediterranean. They accidentally stumbled upon the perfect place to show that restoration of water cycles can be done and can bring enormous benefits ecologically, socially, and financially. We talk about the effect of water vapor on cooling the planet and, of course, our tunnel vision focus on carbon. Join me in a wide-ranging interview with a former dredging professional turned ecosystem restorer and learn what it has to do with fish. If it's true that water vapor accounts for 60 to 70% of the greenhouse effect, while CO2 only accounts for 25%, why do we rarely discuss it? Maybe we choose to ignore it because it means we literally need to revegetate the entire earth. Bring back the marshes, the mangroves, the perennial pastures with trees, and regrow real forests that can bring back rain in strategic places. In short, bring back life, lots of plants, trees, animals back to many places on this earth. Natural climate engineering. It is time we take our role as keystone species super seriously. In this special water cycle series, we interview the dreamers and the doers who are using the latest technology to figure out where to intervene first. They're making or trying to make the investment and return calculations and plans. So what's missing? What's holding us back? Maybe we lack the imagination to back them and try regeneration at scale. We're thankful for the support of the Nest Family Office in order to make this series. The Nest is a family office dedicated to building a more resilient food system through supporting natural solutions and innovative technologies that change the way we produce food. You can find out more on the Nest FO, that is nestfo.com. Welcome to another episode. Today with Thijs van der Hoeve, Creative Director of the Weathermakers. Welcome, Thijs.
Hello. Nice to have me.
And to start, I'm obviously going to link to a great interview, by the way, you did with Ben Goldsmith on rewilding and to an interview we did with one of your co-founders, Maddie, in 2021. So don't go there, listen to it now. But just as a small introduction to your own journey, I always like to ask, how did you end up focusing on soil? I mean, I know a bit of your background and the journey has been soil, let's say, from underneath the ocean bedding. But how did you end up focusing so much on let's say, the living soil or the above sea level soil?
Yeah, my career started in the dredging industry. So I always was busy with earth movement on a very large scale. And I was working
in for anybody knows, dredging is these immense ships that basically pump up, if I said that's probably not the word, but pump up sand and ocean movement to put it somewhere else, either to create protection or new islands or anything. But it's basically taking soil or sand that's on the ocean bottom and put it somewhere else. Massive ships keeping rivers, open for ships, etc. That kind of work, which the Netherlands has a massive industry on that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I started with one of the palm tree islands in Dubai. I normally now say I'm lucky there's a tree in the name, and did large scale port reclamations, dredging of channels, etc. And was already, my sister started to work with Greenpeace, and I promised her to try to re-green the contractor from inside out, not having a clue what would happen. And at a certain moment, I was busy actually with building with nature, so actually start using nature in designs of ports, of reclamations, etc., to reduce cost and to increase or to reduce the negative impacts of these ports. But I got completely fed up with the fact that lots of the times you would plan you would kill lots of coastal systems or natural systems, and you would plant one tree back. And you said, "Nah, we plant a tree."
And the net benefit is good. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Blah, blah, blah. I normally call it in Dutch, het doekje voor het bloeden. But so not really trying to hide the negative impact.
I'm trying to come up with the English version, but I don't know. Let's say it very, very little impact. What is it? It's like some marginal intervention that really looks really well on the brochure, but doesn't really have any concrete impact.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then I was busy actually at a certain moment with diving a little bit more into aquatic ecosystems and how to use them. And then all of a sudden, 19th of January 2016, I got a call from the former project manager of the Suez Canal, which is a known dredging project as well from Egypt. And he was requested by an Egyptian government person to look into the ecosystem collapse, which was happening in a lagoon, where fish stock was disappearing, where the future perspective of the inhabitants or the local communities was simply gone, and it created a lot of social unrest. And if we didn't know what we could do about it, and I followed my intuition, and I thought I did. And I started really with the lagoon itself, and I'm a morphologist from education. So I started to understand that we could change, we could capture the tidal energy which was passing this lagoon twice a day. And with that flood water, I could flush the lagoon, could reduce the salinity, could stabilize the temperatures, and could steer up the very fertile marine sediments there on the bottom. And only looking into that, it was really an eye-opening for me and Malik, because we could start understanding that if you simply look back on how productive this lagoon used to be, you could see the siltation of the lagoon in the history, and I could do a hindcast calculation to predict the potential natural productivity if we would increase the tidal prism, so the water that flows in and out via flood and ebb. And it was tremendous. And that was really, we started to understand that this would potentially mean no unemployment anymore in these coastal areas. And the main driver for me and Malik, Malik is half Algerian, half Belgian, and I worked a lot in the Middle East, and I got completely fed up with the polarization which is happening in the world between so many different people. And we started to realize, wow, we could really mean something for those people there. And then you got the whole story in Europe about refugees and how much a refugee would cost in the Netherlands, and that we should better keep them in their own place and give them a future perspective. So we started to understand that this was an amazing business case. And from there, we started to work. And then after a couple of weeks, because this was only in the beginning, Malik actually said to me, "Tis, I'd never understood why we're dumping normally offshore marine sediments. Because they're very fertile, and you know that because you're from the Netherlands, and the majority of your productive agricultural fields is the old seabed." I'm like, "Damn, you got a point there, man." So we started to analyze what's in those soils, and we started to understand that everything, only lacking phosphor, but everything was in there in nutrients and minerals, and even microbial communities which were inactive. So we started to understand that we should use
these. We're dumping like treasure, basically. So we would, even if you would just take this lagoon, which has been filling up slowly, to revitalize it, but not take into consideration what you're pumping out or what you're taking, what you're dredging, and dumping it somewhere, potentially far away from the shore, etc. But you're saying actually, it's a good breeding ground. It's a good soil amendment, or even just soil in a region that is desertifying and is really suffering from not having having that. So you're basically, and that's a double click, of course. When that happened, you suddenly realized, wow, there's the potential for the marine environment to revitalize and to be productive again. And actually, there's a potential for agriculture and soil.
And the funny thing is, Malik tipped me on it, but what I in the same time saw, as a morphologist, you know, if you increase your tidal velocities, which are normally in normal patterns flowing in spiral flows, so they're creating also upwellings. So what tidal prism does, it picks up again. Like if water is salt, the salt is a natural flocculator, right? So if sediments from desert winds or organic materials are deposited in the lagoon, they go into a chemical reaction with the salt, they flocculate, and they settle down at the bottom. And normally what the tide does, they recycle these nutrients again by upwelling them into the water column. And on the slack tide, so which is the high water, they deposit the organics and the marine sediments
outside the shore of the lagoon.
And on these mudflats, the salt marshes or the mangroves are the most productive ecosystems, parts of the ecosystem we have in the world. And what they're doing, they're continuously battling to become a freshwater system, or to battle towards the waves, which again, reducing them. So you can very quickly see that the natural system is transforming these marine sediments towards a fresh ecosystem on the longer term. So what we started to understand when I saw this, I said, like, damn, Malik, you got a point. These are the indigenous soils that used to be on that Sinai. And when you look on the Sinai from the satellites, you can see the old river system. But all the soils are there completely eroded in thousands of years by flash floods and et cetera. So we thought if everybody talks about, and I was not an ecologist at that moment, if everybody talks about indigenous plants, why don't we talk about indigenous soils? Because it are the composition of these soils from the grain size towards the nutrients, towards the minerals, which determines the productivity of those soils in the old days on the land. So we started to understand, okay, wait a minute. If the organic components are the kickstarter of a new ecosystem, we should use the dead organic matter from the plants that used to be there. So you have a much higher opportunity to have success when you start regreening. And the funny thing is, it sometimes a lot starts where you see the problem. But in 1953, when we had a big flooding in the Netherlands, it's not that these agricultural lands are not productive anymore now. In other words, mm-hmm. get rid of the salt. So for me, it was, okay, the salt actually preserved these soils for us in the lagoon, 2.5 billion cubic meters, ranging from organic content from 5 to 15%. Well, every permaculture wow. person gets crazy about it.
Would go bananas, yeah.
Of course, that also has to do with the segregation which is happening. So we never were able to go too deep, but there's approximately a 5 to 15 meter thick layer of sapkas. And the sapkas are the very salty, fertile marine sediments. So we're like, yeah, we're going to use it. And then the funny
thing, there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, for me, at that moment, I didn't start directly with the soils. The soils for me was the material what I was going to dredge anyway, and I knew that I need soils to grow plants. But for me, it was really the water cycle that triggered me well from the beginning. Because what I started to understand myself is that those wetlands, if you restore them, what the wetlands do, they transform salt water to fresh water vapor. So the water vapor is your...
Do you remember when that trigger came? Because I think somehow in, I'm going to say this space, which is obviously not true, but we're very often, and that's why we're doing this series on water cycles as well, but we're very often stuck or we stay within, okay, we're going to regenerate this piece of land, or we're going to work on this farm or on this plot or even on this lagoon, etc. But then to take it up literally a few notches or a few levels and to start talking about how this influences the water cycle above this piece of land and around, like, was it a natural click for you? Was it a trigger? Did you read something? Like, what happened there? Because of course, going from dredging soil sediments to water vapor is quite a step.
Now you really have to see that, as what I said, I'm an intuitive person. So lots of the times I've got an intuition. I follow it, try to get up, and I like engineering, so I like to get up with a kind of calculation method, and then I say, okay, wow, I'm talking here about something. And I spend a lot of my time sailing with my parents in the Eastern Scheldt in the Netherlands, in a big estuary. So I know I played as a little kid all the time in the salt marges and in those coastal systems. So for some reason, it was within my intuitive thinking. So I started to do that. And I also knew that in those marges, it's cool. Yeah, okay, why is it cool? Because the evaporation happens. Oh, wait a minute. And then I got triggered by Malik telling me we should reuse those sediments. And why we said it, because if I can reuse the sediments, I can first of all reduce costs to dump them offshore. Second of all, and we call this resource-based dredging, I create a resource for the future. So all of a sudden, I'm creating more value. It's a kind of an holistic approach to, first of all, the lagoon, what we were going to do. And then, of course, when Malik told me this and I was in Cairo and I was flying back and I was looking at Google Earth and you could just see that river system. And I used to do in my career, I created workability software tools. So I created for dredging vessels offshore how to predict better and read better a weather forecast, know the limits on the ships. So I know a lot about weather. I'm also a sailor, so I can see what weather is coming from the clouds. And then I started to understand, like, wait a minute, if there used to be a river system, it's warmer, so there's more water vapor in the atmosphere, and there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So my intuitive feeling said, wait a minute, there's not a reason why this desert is a desert. Okay, wait, let me Google a little bit on the historical perspectives. And when I was reading the wobble of the axis of the Earth, I didn't find it a very solid evidence, if I'm honest. I know it has a big influence, but what wasn't the reason, because I figured out that the last human African period stopped in 100 to 200 years. I told you I can like calculation. The wobble of the axis of the Earth is 25,000 years approximately. So how the hell can a change in 200 years be connected to that? It will definitely be an important, play an important role, but it can never be the main thing. So then I saw the river system. I'm like, wait a minute. Then if I have soil and if I plant a plant creates shadow. Yep. Cooler air. So it can hold less moisture. Hey, wait a minute. I'm pulling down this cloud condensation level. The same time I'm restoring my wetlands, and where the energy of the sun is being transformed in evaporation, it doesn't only cool down, it also reduces your thermal flow. So it reduces your low pressure. So it reduces your wind speed. And then in my head, I was like, wait a minute, these are positive feedback loops. And this is what Malik and I all the time saw in those natural systems, are positive feedback loops. And then I said to Malik, wait a minute, man, how much does it cost if we dredge the soils to pump it directly up into the mountains and start processing it there? Yeah, well, geez, that's maybe twice as much as energy. You have to understand, if you cut the soil, you have to suspend the soil, that costs a lot of energy. But the moment you have it in suspension, hydraulic transport is by far the cheapest transport method, for sure, for finer materials. We're like, wait a minute, we're onto something. It's actually quite funny, because the seawater still holds some phosphorus. If to pump these materials over longer distances, you want low densities. And I did a quick calculation. Wait a minute. So I got also my phosphor problem tackled. And then I said to Malik, wait a minute. If I pump it up into a mountain, there let the seawater segregate from the sediments, let the seawater evaporate, pick up in density, and I let it flow back to the ocean, I get approximately 70 to 80% of my energy back. And you're like, wow. So we're increasing the water vapor. We're using the natural system in a proper water cycle. So damn, we're onto something there. And then we just said, okay, wait a minute. Now let's be contractors. We want to create an opportunity. Let us just build a plan. How much soil we're going to dredge? How much food security and fish that's going to give? And with those sediments we're going to dredge, we want to reuse them and see if we can start restoring the river system. And if you look at Google Earth, you can very clearly see where you have to start regreening. Because the beautiful thing is you see the river system and you see the wind erosion on the leeward side or from the south side of this watershed. And there you can beautifully see where the most water vapor is within the air, because there it creates the most wind erosion. So there we could rather quickly understand, okay, we have to start with this river. Created the whole plan. Everybody was a little bit, couldn't fully understand me and Malik what we were saying. So a friend of mine said, please make a sketch. So I started to make these sketches, right? So you got the Sinai, which is a beautiful triangular shape, approximately from the coast to the highest point is 250 kilometers, 1700 meters in elevation. So we started to make the plan. Restore the lagoon, restore approximately 200 to 300 square kilometers in wetlands, increase there the water vapor, then start higher up in the mountains. Somebody showed me John Liu and the Green Gold, so I started to see what they did. And we started to make all of the calculation. And by drawing it myself, I saw that I flipped the wind. Because nowadays, when it's a desert, almost 60 to 70% of the energy is transformed into sensible heat. This is global warming. Then you get a thermal flow, low pressure, and you get a very strong wind over the edge of the Earth, dropping into the Red Sea on the south side. But when I would reduce the salinity of my lagoon, would increase my water vapor already there, would have the wetlands as evaporation factories. What you see is the availability of water there reduces the temperature, reduces the low pressure. So the wind doesn't go that quick over the land, but goes a little bit higher up, goes less quick, and has evaporated moisture coming from the plants. And then I could see that I could reach cloud condensation levels again. That was what I was drawing. But if you get cloud condensation,
you could actually seed the rain or create. Yeah. I mean, create is an interesting word here, but create the rain or the rains that used to be there regularly.
Yeah, and then if water vapor condensates, the air implodes. So I saw that on a higher elevation, I was sucking sea breeze in.
And which then has more water in it anyway, yeah.
If you got cloud condensation, you got these cauliflower clouds. Why? Because the droplets are cycling and cycling and cycling, because the moment they condensate, they heat up the air, so the droplet is going to rise. But when the droplet is big enough, it falls down. And I never forget a Volvo Ocean race with the women boat completely beating all the men boats, because what they've clearly understood then is when a cloud would suck wind and would build up, and when she would fall and change the wind. So I'm like, if the droplet is big enough so gravity wins it from the thermal rise, she falls down, creates a drag force, and I'm flipping the wind. And I saw the water cycle. I'm like, wait a minute. So I Googled it up and I started to read about the water cycle. I'm like, wow, damn, this makes sense. And then we started to unleash it all. So we could calculate on how big this water cycle needs to be, et cetera. But I could also see, further zooming out, that regionally, this was a massive, massive change. Because for me, it clearly showed that this was the leakage of the water vapor from the encatchment basin of the Mediterranean, where Southern Europe is completely connected with Northern Africa as the Nile River in the heart of this encatchment basin. And then John Liu, I was traveling with him in the Les Plateaux, and I never forget it. I was sitting in Yan'an in a cave hotel. He was playing his guitar. We had this crazy day driving around the Les Plateaux, which fully changed my mindset, because there I could see, yes, we can restore large-scale damaged ecosystems. And he was playing guitar, and at a certain moment he said, "Tis, I got to ask you something," because I showed him all my sketches. He said, "Do you know Miami Yen?" I said, "No." "Tis, you have to be honest. Do you know Miami Yen?" "No, man." And then he showed me his sketches, and they are almost identical. And he wrote an email to Miami Yen. "Miami Yen, you need to meet Tis." And when I came back from China a couple of weeks later, I traveled up to Miami Yen, and that was for me an eye-opener, because he could fully fill in my intuitive feeling, which I wasn't fully able yet to, I could calculate with it, but I couldn't fully explain it. And he just nailed it down. And he took me around Valencia, and he could say, like, "Tis, wait. And he lives in an apartment in Valencia. He said, "Tis, first we go to the rooftop. It's 26 degrees, Tis. There's approximately 14 grams of water vapor now above the ocean. And if you see there the Beliara, you can already see the local water cycle starting up." "Okay. Yep. And let us now drive to the Continental Divide." So we drove up to his house close by the Continental Divide. And the Continental Divide, he explained to me, is nothing else than a mountain range high enough to separate weather systems. And the Continental Divide, which is going across Spain, creates the difference between the Mediterranean side and the Atlantic side. And he was explaining me this, and he was telling me all the historical facts. And at a certain moment, we were driving back. He said, "Okay, these, stop the car. Walk outside. Do you see that mountain range there?" Yeah. "I told you this morning, 14 grams, which is now picked up to approximately 20 grams. And there you see the cloud coming up. Give it 1 or 2 minutes." And bam, the cloud was there. I'm like, wow. So how do you do this? He said, "Please."
This guy has a trick. Yeah.
This is data.
He knows his stuff. Yeah.
He started to explain to me about water bed is water, soil is the womb, vegetation is the midwife. This is his summary of his work. And then he said, "Please, I cannot tell exactly what you are saying on the Sinai is true, But what I can tell you, you're on spot on in your thinking, because this is how I created all my stuff. And he took a map with all the catchment basins of the world. And he said, look at it. Please, what is there on the Sinai? I said, damn, there's a continental divide on the Sinai. There used to be a separation between the Mediterranean catchment basin and the Indian Ocean catchment basin. But I said, man, then I have to show you something. Because he actually explained to me, Thies, I think you're right. Because I think, and I cannot argue if you can restore it, but what you see is that there used to be this continental divide, dividing the watershed to the Mediterranean and the south watersheds going to the Red Sea. And that means, Thies, that if that mountain has a vegetation cover which is functional, there is sufficient amount of circulation. And she changed that wind exactly how you say. And that means to say that in the majority of your days, you should not have any leakage towards the Red Sea. And I showed him the wind maps. I, of course, downloaded it. Because as an engineer, if I wanted to convince myself about that wind going over the Red Sea or being closed, I thought, okay, the only way I can prove this is look at the difference between the summer and the winter in the Sinai. And you can clearly see in the summer when it's approximately 15 degrees warmer on average on a day and a night, you see the very strong southern breeze towards the Red Sea. And the whole Red Sea has a southern direction of approximately 3 to 4 Beauforts on average on a month during day and night. And in the winter, there you can already see halfway the Red Sea, the pressure coming back from the Indian Ocean. And also Mian started to shiver a bit. And he's like, wow, man, this could mean something. And he said, you know, let us not go too wild, but I can tell you one thing. You just found the smallest, most complete watershed in the world, from continental divide to the coast, which is the Sinai. So you, by incidence, because that's what it was, just found the perfect spot to show what
to show what is possible.
Absolutely.
And then from there, this is almost, it sounds like magic. I've used the word, I think, in the interview with Maddie as well, in a sense that it sort of triggers us and forces us to think as keystone species, or to think as really weather makers. I mean, obviously you should pick the name for that. But then when you go into the offices of decision makers, of financiers, investors, and people that, let's say, are in charge of resources, either the land or decisions, how do you make sure you're not being put in the crazy corner and like, this is nice, but just restore a few fishes, because that's what we basically asked, or just restore, like, how do you make sure this is taken seriously, as it is very serious, enormous potential, potentially the smallest scale way we can show water cycles being restored, but you also don't want to be put in a corner with a crazy head on and not being listened, even though the engineering underneath, the calculations are very sound, simply because we've never done this before at this scale, or haven't shown many examples of, okay, this is project number 15, we know the drill, we know the risks, etc. Like, how do you make sure you've been taken seriously?
It's a good question. Well, first of all, the first couple of years, we weren't always taken seriously, and people thought I was crazy. But and I had some connections higher up in the Dutch government, just normally how I would do my work. That was recognized by, for example, the director of the public works in the Netherlands. And he, at a certain moment, asked me, drop by my office, Steve, what are you doing, et cetera, et cetera. And I showed him, in trust, this project. The funny thing was, I consider him as a friend, but he was rather religious. And I didn't know yet that this is also, of course, one of the most spiritual grounds on the planet. And he said, Thies, I believe you. I'm like, oh, that goes quick. Yeah, but this is my belief. I said, wow. So I never thought about it like that. So what I think the real answer is to what you say, the two things. Yes, you are going to be called crazy, but yeah, to be quite honest, I don't really care. If I believe in something, I go for it. Second of all, it touches people. The narrative of the Sinai makes people move. It touches people in their heart or something. So Jan Hendrik took me to the minister, and she was Melanie Schultz, and she loved the concept. You have to realize that I came in there in that moment in time. I was a little bit energetic. I was talking to about Marshall Plan 2. We restore the Sinai with the whole offshore and dredging industry, which will not have a future anyway because we're going to step away from the fossils. So, yeah, man, there are all marine deposits around Africa. We're going to make a brotherhood with Africa, and this will, we can become the geopolitical leader out of love. And she was like, okay. And she started to connect me with some other people. And she said, okay, please listen. The way of passion and commitment, I was not alone with the whole team around us, you're putting down needs to be recognized anyway. So let us set up a convention, and I'm going to ask technical reviews from my institutes, so which was Wageningen Academy and Delta, etc. And in the meantime, John Leo was connecting me to John Todd, Tim Flannery, Thomas Gerow, Lee Ray, to all of those people. So I felt that I normally call them my Jedis. I felt protected in my way of thinking by these people. They all came, like Mian, they all came to that convention. And there I started to realize is that our current society is very set up into silos, and holistical thinking is not into our system. But all the people I've met, which I worship almost, or which inspire me, are all holistical thinkers. And the interesting thing, because if you start understanding a natural system, and if you start to see her capabilities, for me, it was always a game not to lose them by telling my real predictions. In other words, I could also always become very conservative on what we were saying. And with that, they were already like, wow, is this the case? And the interesting thing is, if you can drop all your assumptions, because it's like biodiversity, if you're building a water cycle approach, you need the plants, you need the animals, you need it all to be able to start predicting what it can do, which means that you can all drop all your assumptions. So everybody gets pretty convinced on the way how you say it. What you also see, you have to build up personal relations. Because if I had a technical review of Kahneman, Wageningen, Deltares, everybody around me, everybody was skeptical. Ah, oh, this is not what we can do, etc., etc. Then if I would meet them after the meeting alone, they would all say, please continue. It's not that what you say is wrong, but man, I cannot say it's right. I said, yeah, but that's fine. It's not about what's exactly right. We need to start understanding which direction we need to go to. And I love that from Green Gold that Jeff Loughton says, what we need to do remains relatively simple. It's lots of work, but what we need to do is relatively simple. Retain moisture and bring the environmental condition back, and nature will build their own complexity. So when I start coming into where we were a little bit different than other regreening projects, I guess, was that we had this lagoon. And an aquatic ecosystem is way quicker in recovery. So the good thing about the fact that it's quicker in recovery, it gives you a much earlier result, which was fish, solid fish. Bam. I could look it back in the last 100 years of fish data. I could show it. The fish is going to get there, my friends. If you would look into the other lagoons of the Mediterranean, you see that the part of the wheel is really, really on the bottom of productivity, where she used to be historically. There are rumors that Caesar went there because the best fish of the Mediterranean was coming out of Butter Wheel, which I can tell you why, but I won't do it right now. It takes too long. So I started to understand, wait, you can just show the other productivities of the lagoon, so you can show this productivity. So that was the first moment the investor starts coming in. After that, I could start talking about carbon credits. But what I already quickly understood is that carbon credits on itself will never fund these projects. But if you start thinking on the water cycle, where the percentage of biomass is much more important than your carbon stored into it, because there are natural systems. They're nice.
So what do you mean by that? Like, why is that?
If I look at the link of climate change towards carbon dioxide, I see, of course, a correlation, but the correlation isn't that strong as it is now changing. It's scary. If I look at the percentage of biomass, which is the breathing system in this water cycle, you see a much stronger relation. With other words.
Meaning, like I think Judith Schwartz said it somewhere, like we devegetated the earth. I don't know if that's the term, but like we reduced the amount of biomass significantly. And you're saying, if I'm correct, that that correlation with a global weirding, warming, whatever we want to call it, mostly warming, is much stronger than the CO2 correlation.
And we knew that already from 1972, but we knew that climate change was due to land use. Now I will add also the ocean to it, and fossil fuel burnings. But the biggest pillar always was land use. If you destroy 60% of the contribution of greenhouse gases is water vapor. If you add water vapor to the game, there's always a discussion to it. Why? Because it determines where your water vapor is in your atmosphere. If your water vapor is higher than 3 kilometers, where it's out of reach of the indirect water cycle effects of your watershed, she is by far the strongest and worst greenhouse gas there is. And of course, if you start looking back, when did the desert occur? When did we deviate from the normal ice time cycles, etc.? Read the book, The Weathermakers. You can beautifully see it descriptive. It was before the Industrial Revolution. No, it was because the hunters and gatherers start chopping down the forest. If you look back at the cycles of the African human period, it became a desert or it became green many, many times. But it used to be way often greener than it was a desert, and that's completely altered the other way around. And if you start understanding that these deserts, these are heat factories on the longer term. And yes, they reflect more light back into the atmosphere, but they create lots of hot air. That's why you see lots of scientists also seeing links with the desertification of the planet and the changing monsoon patterns, which makes sense because a desert has lots of high pressures, so those lower systems cannot come there. And if you look at it like that, you can start understanding that it's your biomass, that every kilo of biomass has a function in this water cycle. And if you then start talking, this is what I'm now doing also with the financial people, I said, listen, let us first tackle the carbon. But I see equivalent to carbon, equivalent to a greenhouse gas, let's call that carbon, it's accepted. I see much more value in the biomass, approximately 4 times more. But not only that, because if we have a functional biodiversity around it, all the little worms, the little rats, the birds, everything is recycling nutrients, which is an accumulation of this living system. And those living systems get more powerful and powerful all the time. That's why they're also very vulnerable if you tackle them. And if you see this, you can actually see a whole accumulation of energy stored into these natural systems. And where are they stored? Into your water cycle. So you can actually predict on the energetic, how do I explain this? Easily. I see water as a battery, right? If you have a desert and the sun comes up, approximately 60 to 70% on global terms is transformed in sensible heat. If you have a vegetation cover, call it an organic infrastructure to control your hydrological cycle, or actually to create your natural water management, on that same day I told you not the 60 to 70% is sensible heat, but 70 to 80% is evaporation. So what happens is the excess of solar energy during the day is transformed into water vapor, which then reduces the heating of your land. That water vapor is stored during the day and will potentially fall in the end of the day or at night down as rain. But this is energy. So you can make an energy
cooling
balance. Yeah, heat is lost, but the water that falls down is cool and creates gravitational energy. So there you can see the bizarre a positive feedback loop's effect on this water cycle. And if you then look at it, what do you need for a water cycle? You need the plants and you need the animals. And this creates lots of this energy being stored into your water cycle, and which frees it up to the species around there. And you just said something funny. Yes, we have to understand we are part of a very big group of weather makers, which is called the organic family. What I normally say to the ministers or the business bidder or the other people, I say, come on, do you believe that we can change the weather? Yeah, well, please, if you now tell this story. I think we could play a role. So, okay, listen, look at the introduction.
Already did.
Look, yeah, indeed. But people then still think, okay, they start to understand the stuff about the water cycle. They say, okay, can we do this? So come on, look at the introduction of the wolf back into the Yellowstone Park. Wolves created rivers. So come on, we can do this, right? Don't get me wrong, I love wolves. I have lots of respect for them, how they're working together, but we can mimic this. Ah, you've got a point there. Yeah. Because the wolves start eating the deer couldn't eat the small trees, the beaver could eat them and could build their dams, it could revitalize all of these systems. Come on,
there's a beautiful video on that, which I will put down. And have you seen, because you've been on this for, let's say, since 2016, you mentioned Weathermaker started in 2017, has the conversation, because you've been doing a lot of education, like has the conversation shifted a bit more in the sense of ambition, in the sense of understanding that we play a key role in this on the negative and the potential positive side? Like what is your hunch now? And then I'm going to ask, of course, where you are now. We're recording this in the summer of 2023. But how has been the conversation? Because I'm imagining the first, because I remember talking about soil and grazing 13 years ago in investment communities, and I saw basically like blank faces, like, what do you mean? And that has shifted. Soil has become a significant topic in many circles. I'm imagining my bubble just became a lot bigger as well. But how has that been, let's say, in the water cycle conversations? Has that shifted the last 6 years, 7 years that you have been on this?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The answer is yes. I can make it a little bit more practical. So why?
No. Very good. And then what does it mean for the Weathermakers, for this specific one? As Mian Mian mentioned, this is probably the most perfect case, not ideally in terms of political situation, in terms of spot, because it's a very important place for many people, many countries. And so it's not the easiest place to work in many ways, but maybe also the best place to do this. Where are you now in 2023? What's the update from, I'm going to say the ground, but in this case, the lagoon? Like where, the latest from the soil?
Let me first respond to your earlier question, because I want to explain it a little bit further. And you said I did a lot of education. I don't believe I did always education. I did more inspiration, because certain things I also don't know yet. But by inspiring people on the force of nature, which is also building our own eco-oasis lab here, which is a combination of John Todd's work and Mian Mian's, we see that we can, we did lots of inspiration. What you also have seen is that, I guess, the geopolitical governance of this world is more and more failing. And we also see that we're failing, for sure, as being the Netherlands, is really doing something on climate change. What I also saw it in the Netherlands is that very rapidly our system is changing. The last 5 years, man, we had droughts, which are scary. And now also here in the Netherlands, people start understanding that the weather is changing way more rapidly than even predicted. With other words, the way how carbon dioxide was used to start predicting changes is, we are now seeing here in the Netherlands, it's not the right way. And more people are starting to talk about heat stresses to take it out with natural systems and start thinking on indeed in retaining moisture. So I see definitely in the Netherlands, and I see not the Netherlands as the example of the world, but I see the Netherlands as a brewing pot of, because we're living with so many people together, we're one of the Western countries which is hitting the limits of growth in our country as we speak, whether it's nitrogen, whether it's carbon, whether it's the availability of fresh water, we're really hitting our limits and we got to change. And I definitely see a change. I also started to work together with scientific groups and universities, which was a trust building process. And now I'm really...
An interesting journey, I think. Yeah.
And I'm really working together with Delft, Leiden, Utrecht, Wageningen, Wetzes. So we are having a lot of spread, and where they can still sometimes be skeptical. And I said, it's fine. Investigate it. And every time we get to the step further, that they say, damn, we're onto something. So that's a process which happened. I last week had the formal director of KNMI here coming to visit me because he heard that much about me. And he said, okay, geez, listen, you guys need to be reviewed by the big global weather forecasting model, which they, together with KNMI and all other people, produce. So I feel that they're doing it. And the funny thing, he said, geez, I do it because this is actually one of the only big thoughts which are really giving me hope, because we're not that much in a hopeful situation now. So it's not always that they completely recognize what we see, but they intuitively have a feeling. So I feel that there is a change happening within our society, which is creating way more. The awareness is kicking in. We now have to start thinking about solutions. And more people see that the only real quick solution is restoration of natural systems, and then we can do all the other things later on. So where are we right now? The last COP27 in the Sinai, of course. We signed a cooperation agreement with the Egyptian government on the Barda Wheel and the Sinai initiative to together start sharing knowledge and ideas. So we completely shared the way how we think they could do it, and are now talking with big investors in the world to start investing in it. And cannot always say too much about it, but it means to say that we're talking on the budgets that you can completely fund the early works. So this is only like really, the first 50 million cubic meters of dredging, which will change the whole food security issue for the local community. So it's still a big, big project, but it's absolutely not in the regreening part yet. There will be regreening pilots, and there will be all stuff going to be organized around. And that's where we now start, where the fish is really the core of the investment, and where carbon credits, nitrogen credits are all being now linked up. And we're actually thinking there, which is a quite interesting way of thinking, I believe, is that you're not selling your carbon credits, because we know that there will be a big growth into the value of them, and you want to have hold the value within your project. But we're using the carbon credits and the potential equivalent carbon credits attached to biomass or the water cycle, which we still have to certify, but we will start that process, into the project as a bond. With other words, a guarantee for future investments. The same for the fish you don't catch in the lagoon, which is a lot because you want to do sustainable fishing. That's your bond for your investment to do it. And in this way, you can trigger this financial system to create their own security in the project itself, so they're always in there for the long term.
How would it work on the carbon side? I understand the non-selling piece immediately, like the holding.
Yep.
But how would that then trigger the necessary flows? Like, how do you make sure, how would that trigger the security, or how would that create, let's say, a flow of capital, even though you didn't sell the credit?
So
you didn't transfer the ownership, sorry.
Yeah, so what we did, for example, on the aquatic potential fish growth, and we created with the University of Wageningen a new type of fishing quotas over the full ecosystem, where, with other words, your fishing enables ecosystem growth. So it's a holistic view on looking on how to catch your surplus of fish which shouldn't be there, which enable the rest of your ecosystem to recover quicker. So the first part is really your fish, where we have already locally in the nation and also towards Europe agreements with potential fish off-takers. So the first grant or the first loans are coming back on that, and there will be a grant coming from some government.
Because that's almost like that's investable, because you know, and that's why you, the point you made before, like aquatic systems are fascinating because they're much faster. Fish, let's say, demand is growing, absolutely needed to be much more sustainably managed. But we've also seen examples in the past, I think, of coastal areas where through a loan system and through quotas, fishermen or fisher people have left it to rest and then started harvesting the surplus over time, and very successful examples. Like that's, you know, like in with these interventions, like the fish will come back in significant numbers because of the speed and because of the intervention. So that's why you say I keep focusing on fish, because of all the other stuff is important, but the fish is the entry point because we need a lot more fish. We have the value of fish. We know how much extra fish there will be soon. Like this is not a 10-year, 20-year thing. These are not trees. These are fish. Yeah.
And by predicting your aquatic growth in the years ahead, not on the individual species, but on type of trophic levels or key species, I can see future fish growth coming up, which part of that money I invest back to pay the fishermen if they put the fish back. So I'm going to reward them by putting the fish back they shouldn't do. And I'm going to additionally award them above the market value to catch the fish, which you need to catch. So there we did this. And in the same time, in this investment, I will put my first blue carbon, so which are the salt margins, it's already certified, I put that as a grant or as a guarantee on that loan. And they are willing to accept it. And I tell them, listen, this holds a value. And the value, and I stick to the blue carbon, which is already certified. But in the same time, I'm going to start up the certification process to show you it's way more than only carbon. It's nitrogen, it's the water, it's the evaporation it does, etc. So listen, guys, not only your carbon price will rise, so your guarantee will become stronger. We can put it to a value, or you can take some additional profit on it, month on all. After I did this, I'm going to almost four times increase my values in there. So you can start seeing that by holding this value within your project scope, within the local community scope, you can very quickly build way better investment opportunities for attract more loans. And then after you did that first process, at a certain moment, you can start selling them off if you would like to. But in principle, we need in the beginning lots of investments, which is always good to stick that into that guaranteed thing. So it's just an accelerator how to bring in more capital. And they are liking a lot this approach.
They meaning the large investors you're talking to now. And so what would your main, I'm trying to be conscious of your time as well, and we'll try to end with a few quicker questions, which never works, but let's try to do that. And what would be your main message to, let's say, a room, and for sure you've given presentations on that, to a room of quote-unquote finance people, investors, that are either investing their own money, other people's money, on this thinking, if they're, because I can imagine there's, it's a lot of info and a lot of inspiration and a lot of education and knowledge as well. But if you had to boil it down to one main message, if you want people to walk out of that room and remember something, what's your main takeaway?
What I always normally do is, besides from the values next to carbon, it can very easily reduce the risk on your investment. And by holistically start thinking, a natural system, you cannot manipulate. So you start with creating this natural system, and it will give you answers on very different topics, whether it are refugees or whether it's our drinking waters, etc. So what we normally say is to them, in the holistic process, it reduces your risk on the short term and it increases your benefits on the longer term. And if you look into a complete water cycle, you can also deviate from earlier gains to a more longer term gain. So I always have to The good thing about thinking large is you can spread your risks and your turnovers in a more easier way. And this is what I normally explain to them, and which this is what they very much like. We're going to step in into some mangrove restoration projects where we're also applying the same methodology to reduce the risks and to provide more benefits along the whole life term of it. If that answers your question.
And if you would be in charge, so let's flip the seats for now. You would be in charge of quite a significant investment fund, like in this kind of water cycle restoration projects. $1 billion doesn't sound like a lot, but it's still a lot. If you would have to put $1 billion to work without any restrictions, the only way would be it had to be an investment. So at some point, but this could be very, very long term, it had to come back. What would you do? I'm not asking for exact dollar amounts. I'm asking where would you focus? Would it be specifically on technology, maybe modeling? Would it be on some early loans? Would it be on developers and project developers like and contractors like the weather makers? What would be your focus if you had $1 billion to put to work?
Straight away start a project.
Where and that? What would that mean? Dredging.
Yeah. Go up for a proper lagoon. I can tell you 53 in the Mediterranean basin. They all can become way more productive than they are right now. Go to the lagoon, call up a dredger, sit down with the local communities, explain to them how their history was, see if they want this, and start dredging and start restoring an aquatic ecosystem, and to show to the people that this is always the start of a very quick recovery of a natural system which can feed the people with food security and social security and improve their livelihoods with the evaporation. And it is always the start of your watershed approach. And I would go to the people that would need it the most. Go to Northern Africa. Help people in the dramatic situations they are now there. They still hold lots of indigenous knowledge, which are way closer to a natural proper management than we are. And go help and support and work together and collaborate and share as much as possible. Directly start. If I would really be in charge, I would start ASEP. Dredging.
And would that mean somewhere else than when you're working now? In the sense of, you say, let's maybe find a place where it's easier in all circumstances to show, and then like sort of like create a bit of FOMO and like what would you pick as the first one? You said where people need it most. That's not always the easiest.
That's political backing.
$1 billion. Yeah. You can do a lot, but you can also lose it very quickly.
Yeah. But for me, I would.
Would you do Spain? Would you do
most likely
Morocco?
By the wheel. For some reasons, you have to realize if you want to inspire and show to the people the force of nature, go to the people that have it the worst at the moment, because they will. Way easier, we see the positive changes. By the wheel, they have been dredging there for 100 years, so they know what it means. And this Egypt needs international support by the stupid war in the Ukraine and the food prices going skyrocket. So I would go there. Because if Egypt gets into a more worse situation, my friend, it's going to be a very, very difficult situation with the Nile and all the countries. I would go there. But of course, I've dedicated my life to it for 6.5 years, so it would always be strange for me to say that I would start something else. If you would tell me I would have 2.5 million, I would start straight away here, across from my farm in the Meuse, buy a little bit of piece of land, build a little bit of a morphological pool where I'm now discussing it with the minister and all of the stuff. Show in the Netherlands. You can build an holistical value proposition based upon the weather making approach or the water cycle and show that, open it up to the world and say, guys, go for it. So it really depends the budget you give me, where I would start.
And as a final question, you don't have $1 billion anymore, unfortunately, but you do have a magic wand, and that means you can change one thing overnight, but one thing only. What would that be?
If I could change in this system?
In anything, globally, in, I usually ask food and ag, but it could be like, could be terrestrial, could be water systems. But one thing, it's true magic, which means it does change overnight, could be restore all the marshes, could be anything, or consciousness, like anything you want. But what would you do if you had that magic power?
Yeah, but then I would say restore the water cycle in the Sinai, because that will stop the leakage, that will start bringing more moisture in the surrounding areas, whether it's Lebanon, Israel, or whether it's going to be Libya. And from there, we can start restoring it. There will be more water coming into the Nile because you stop it. So you reduce the conflict currently start building up here in Egypt and with all those lands. And from there, we can show it direct, without a doubt, it's going to be the Sinai cycle.
I want to thank you so much, Thies, for... Sorry, go ahead.
Now, because I can tell you, and I just got a friend of mine is actually walking on Corsica. Let's stop with this, but just to explain to you how damn sure I am about the big thing. He's just walking on
Corsica. I will wrap up. I will wrap up. One second.
Okay.
Oh, you want to record this as well?
I want to tell it. He's walking...
Please go ahead.
He's walking on Corsica now, and I told him, my friend, go to the southeast side. He's now working with me already for a year on this project. There you find the Levant terraces, which you have in all the islands in the Mediterranean on the southeast side. I was walking there myself and I saw Levant terraces. The Sinai is the Levant tectonic plate. So I'm like, hey. So I call up Miamian. I said, Miamian, what's this? What? We got Levant terraces here. Yeah, these. But you know, that very, very long ago, the winter rain would come from the Levant. I said, but that's exactly what we're showing here with that Sinai. Yes. If we start looking back in the historical facts, we can see that answer. Yes, we can change if we want. I'm not talking about the whole social processes, because we need to fully use the indigenous knowledge, etc. But if we want, we can easily regreen. 25% of our planet is a desert. And if we restore functional ecosystem with functional watersheds, we're not living with too many people on this planet. We're now doing too much stupid stuff with too many people on this planet. We need to, as a paradigm shift, John Lee would say, start understanding we're part of a natural system. And together with all of our organic families, the beavers, the fishes, the algaes, birds, we can restore these water cycles. And if we do, there's a beautiful future perspective ahead of us.
It's fascinating that knowledge was and is there, and the winter rains come from the Levant, of course. And we have to rediscover through all the models and all the research and all the reading and calling experts, obviously, like Mian. I want to thank you so much, Thies, for your time. I think we could do another few hours, but I want to be conscious of your time and the time of our listeners. I invite you all to dive much deeper into the topics. We only literally scratched the surface, pun definitely intended in this case. And thank you so much for the work you do. And thank you for coming on here to share about it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again, and see you next time.